So the idea starts with Paseo Pantera, which was to try and rescue the jaguar. The jaguar is interrupted in its travel up and down, and it should be able to flow all the way down to Patagonia. In areas like in Chiapas and Mexico, a lot of the initial roads that were built more for controlling the communities and for the army to be able to penetrate. And so when you talk to people and say, why are they building roads? What are they going to come do to us? The distrust is they're trying to divide us, they're trying to make us leave here, they're trying to kill my cattle because I can't cross the highway with the cattle.
How do the public and the government think about Trump's administration and his, I guess, new foreign policy approach?
Right now, 80% of our exports go to the United States. So completely alienating yourself from the United States is going to be very painful.
What is North American regionalism?
Things like that don't know borders. So the rain or the pollution that comes up from one country rains on the other country. And so you have to come with an agreement, you have to work together to try and solve some of these issues that aren't going to stay within their little borders.
Can you also talk to us a little bit about how you approach teaching theory to your students?
When I teach theory, I try not to put a lot of my point of view. How would Abraham Lincoln explain something to Donald Trump? Depends on where you're standing.
If you have one key message to deliver to policymakers in Mesoamerica, what would it be and why? Welcome to New Regional Orders, a podcast by the Center for Regional Integration. I'm your host and the center's founding director, Ivo Ganchev. On this episode of the show, we turn our attention to Mesoamerica, a subregion strategically located between North and South America, which has received relatively little attention in scholarly debates on international affairs. We also explore topics such as Mexico's role in North American and Latin American regionalism and dive deep into discussions about teaching international relations and political theory at the university level. My guest is Dr. Alina Gamboa Combs from Universidad Anáhuac in Mexico. She is the author of Regional Integration, Development, and Governance in Mesoamerica, which to my knowledge is the most detailed English language study on these topics covering the region. She has also published on a number of related topics and contributed a chapter to a book that I had the pleasure of editing last year. Having collaborated with Alina before, it was a great pleasure for me to meet with her for this conversation in Mexico City, and I'm really excited to share it with you. I hope that you enjoy the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. So let's roll the intro and get started. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Ivo Ganchev, Beijing-based academic, executive, and consultant.
I wanted to try the theory on you.
Yeah, esa es una pregunta para un examen de grado, para un examen de grado.
Go to the communities and listen to people, and listen to people, and listen to people.
Exploring change across the borders, welcome to New Regional Orders.
And it's my great pleasure to welcome on the show today Dr. Alina Gamboa Combs, who has graciously welcomed us at Anáhuac University in Mexico. Alina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Likewise, it's a pleasure to have you as a guest. Now, the name of the podcast is New Regional Orders, and your research has been focusing on the Mesoamerican region. But when I was preparing for the episode and I searched for regional integration in Mesoamerica, your book was the top result that came out, which tells us that you're one of the leading scholars in this area. But when people think about Mesoamerica, it's often defined as a cultural area, as a historical region, and not a lot of people think about it in terms of regional integration. So to set the stage for our discussion, can you explain how do you define Mesoamerica, both from a historical and a contemporary perspective, and what drew your attention to the region in researching it?
Okay, so Mesoamerica, normally you consider from the mid to the south part of Mexico, most of Central America, and parts of South America, where Central America sort of touches parts of Colombia, etc. For a lot of people, the cultural definition comes from the use of maize, that it was the cultures that had maize as a staple food, and that they were sedentary cultures, that they weren't nomadic cultures, they were sedentary, they raised their maize, and that was their staple food. So that's more of the cultural, and a lot of the pre-Hispanic cultures that are found there are the ones that consider as part of this heritage of Mesoamerica. Now, right at this point in time, Mesoamerica has sort of evolved as far as a term because of a project that started in 2001, which was the Plan Puebla Panamá. That involved the lower parts of Mexico and Central America. And the reason for this project was because there was observation that this part of Mexico and Central America had very similar rates of poverty, rates of development, and had very similar economies. And so the idea was to try and raise the economic capacity of this area, and because they have very similar problems, that it would be easier to tackle them as a region and not individually. So Mexico spearheaded this project, starting with Presidente Fox, and wanted to propose that these southern parts of Mexico and Central America would join together for this regional project. And that's what's basically brought my interest in. And from the beginning, there was a bit of debate on whether this was regional integration or not. But the nature of the project was a lot of cooperation to a point of integration. So that's why we could do consider it part of regional integration.
Right. So the Plan Puebla Panamá evolved into the Proyecto Mesoamérica. And there are also other regional organizations like SICA, the Central American Regional Integration Organization, which forms a landscape of regional integration mechanisms in this part of the world. Can you briefly introduce how is Proyecto Mesoamerica situated in this landscape of regional integration initiatives in the region? And are there any particularly important formal or informal mechanisms that you'd like to highlight in this region?
But what's been interesting in this particular region is that there are so many projects that overlap one over the other that, first of all, you have to be very careful that they don't contradict one another and that they're not pushing for the same objective, but using the very limited resources and pulling away from others that might be using it more efficiently. So this is an issue that, that is highlighted, in my research for one, but in other research as well, that SICA and CIECA are very formal regional integration. So Central America has a long history of institutions for regional integration, and their regional integration was very much based on the model of the European Union. In fact, the European Union does a lot of consulting to help them emulate the model even more. And so they have a parliament, they have other things that have very similar characteristics from the European Union. What happens with Proyecto Mesoamerica is it's more project by project, and there are different areas that they're looking into. So one of the first ones was a highway integration, so helping the highways to communicate so that you can transport products from once Colombia joined, from Colombia all the way through Mexico. The southernmost highways in Mexico are not as wide or as helpful as some of the northern ones. So here it's been helping to bring about repaving and building better roads, as well as helping with customs and facilitating some of the goods. So there you can see this broadening of integration in a very practical way.
Yeah, that's a fascinating insight in terms of how the mechanisms of integration work in this part of the world. And you mentioned the European Union, which serves, I dare say, as a model for a lot of regional integration organizations and mechanisms in Latin and South America as well. And there is a whole strand of the literature that argues that sometimes these mechanisms are successful or unsuccessful, and often that's done by comparing them to the European Union and comparing the achievements that regional integration has achieved, for instance, well, different parts of Latin America and in Europe. So when you think about the mechanism that you mentioned in Mesoamerica, that could be Proyecto Mesoamerica or SICA or CIECA or anything else, how do you determine whether they're successful or unsuccessful? Or if you don't have a specific definition, what's your logic when you think about this question?
I think one of the first problems with Plan Puebla Panamá is they didn't have very specific objectives. So for me, for a project to be successful, you'd have to have a specific objective and work towards it. Maybe not achieve it 100%, but get towards it. So one of some of the measurable results that you can find from Plan Puebla Panamá are the times that it's taken, the time reduction of transport and going through customs, for example. So that has definitely been a very measurable result, as well as the amount of trade increase among the countries. One very clear characteristics of Central America and Mexico is that we tend to trade more with the outside world, more towards the US, towards Europe, to other places, and not as much amongst each other. That we tend to compete more with the kind of products. And so we've seen more investment of Mexican companies in Central America. We've seen an increase in like telecommunications, for example. Telmex has now quite a few offices in Central America, and we have also had the electrical grid that's been increasing the amount of electricity and how, or at least reducing the loss of electricity from poor infrastructure. So all of these things, I think, are a way to measure. We don't have it quantified, or they haven't quantified it in a way that's very clear, but you can measure specific aspects, no? Times for transport, loss of electricity, etc. You can find some, and gathering them together, you can see some advancement in the projects.
Yeah, that definitely helps when you're trying to measure whether certain goals are achieved or worked towards. And you've mentioned a lot of goals that have to do with increasing efficiency that are, in some ways, even if they're not quantified, they're somehow quantifiable. So that's on the economic side. Mostly, at least from what I gather so far. But are there any social development projects that have benefited from regional integration in Mesoamerica, or perhaps efforts that were tried but stalled in the process?
Well, there were quite a few efforts that began. They took a lot of starting point of what the households were like in Mesoamerica. So, for example, finding that there was, how many households had running water, how many of these had electricity, how many of them had access, how many people had access to schools, and so they were wanting to increase the amount, help the people have more access to services. That hasn't been a very clear project, or at least the investment. What happened with Plan Puebla Panamá specifically is that budgets were given for a lot of the infrastructure projects, but not as much for the social projects. Each country was supposed to decide how much they were going to put into education, health, etc. So once you take it back to the national budget, and particularly in Central America, they were expecting huge Mexican investments in their social. So that hasn't gone so well. And recently, as not so much as part of Proyecto Mesoamerica, but part of what Mexico is doing in Central America, they've been doing, they started in the southeast of Mexico, the Sembrando Futuro, which is getting a lot more for food security, growing a lot more food. And that program they've extended to Central America. The current president doesn't want to say that it's part of Proyecto Mesoamerica because not the current, the previous president didn't want to say that it was for Proyecto Mesoamerica because it wasn't his idea. So, but it still is, we see that cooperation with Central America continue. And that one, I think, is one that will probably continue through this presidency and help with food security in general.
Yeah, your comment here really touches on a lot of fundamental issues, such as who takes credit for certain initiatives when it's successful, when it's supposed to be a joint initiative or a regional initiative of the domestic powers, the governments that are currently in power looking to somehow increase their legitimacy and basically gain points in front of their voters. And also there is the other issue of sort of the imbalance of development levels or capacity, which we've seen in many other regions. We've also seen it even in the European Union, which is supposed to be the most advanced mechanism. You see great disparities between North and South, East and West, and so on. But getting back to the topic of Mesoamerican integration initiatives, you've researched the Mesoamerican Biological Corridor, which is a fascinating initiative. It emphasizes partnerships with indigenous communities, which is one of its, I guess, more unique aspects. Can you tell us a little bit more about this mechanism? How does it operate? What does it aim to achieve? And what kind of outcomes has it produced so far?
Well, the biological corridor has a lot of different facets. One of the things is to make sure that you have a continuous corridor, particularly for flora and fauna to be able to flourish. If you cut off, you have cities and roads interrupting the natural flow of animal life and plant life, you really start to strangle them genetically and even to the point where they don't reproduce and you lose a lot of species. So the idea starts with Paseo Pantera, which was to try and rescue the jaguar. The jaguar is interrupted in its travel up and down, and it should be able to flow all the way down to Patagonia. So the idea was these large cats, which are umbrella species. They're the ones that sort of the top of the food chain and manage a lot of the ecosystem, that they would have this ability to travel up and down and be able to mate with other large cats and not strangle the genetic material of these communities, some of these large cat communities. So here it was trying to find a way to connect as much as possible so that both the cats can go, but also that you have these areas that seeds can fly. You have a lot of the, because you interrupt it not just with cities, we interrupt with farmland, with clearing away part of the jungle to keep to grow food for people, that you don't have the natural flow of the natural flora in such a small area of isthmus. Central America is quite skinny, and there are parts of Central America that right now are being deforested to the point where we have what you call now a dry corridor, an area that has gone so dry that people are migrating and leaving because they don't have food sources. So there's a lot of complexity there that's trying to be solved with this biological corridor. The idea is to stop deforestation. The idea is to find ways. And as you were mentioning, the indigenous communities, they had different farming different farming practices. And so these farming practices are a lot more sustainable. And for example, they tend to plant amongst the natural plants in the jungle. They tend to find ways for cohabited and to not deplete so much from the soil. And so learning from them is very helpful. And as well, so part of the corridor project is to go and work with the communities to learn from them, but also teach them what it means that when you slash and burn in the jungle, what it's going to do to the soil and to the ecosystem in general.
Yeah, that's definitely an aspect that's not received enough attention, I think, over the past decades, and especially with the expansion of the economic expansion of many places in the world. I think there might be a lot of lessons to learn here from this project in Mesoamerica. Now, your research has involved extensive field work. You've talked to government officials, NGOs, community groups. I noticed that many of your interviewees expressed a degree of distrust in their governments and regional institutions. Can you tell us a little bit about the reasons behind this distrust? How can trust be built to foster more effective collaboration? And are there any other fascinating insights from these interviews that you think are worth mentioning or highlighting here as well?
A lot of the distrust, I mean, a lot of it is something that I think is rightfully there. The governments have ignored, particularly some of the indigenous communities. And if you see, for example, Guatemala, some of the issues that happened in the 1990s against, well, in before 80s and 90s against the indigenous communities, you can understand why they don't trust their governments. So when their governments are saying, we're going to help your community thrive, they're going, yeah, what do you want? That's also in areas like in Chiapas and Mexico, a lot of the initial roads that were built more for controlling the communities and for the army to be able to penetrate. And so when you talk to people and say, why are they building roads? What are they going to come do to us? They're not trusting. Other ones were just really overlooked. Just the fact that people didn't do their homework before they started some of the things in the projects. So we saw a lot with roads, and as you travel down, for example, through Tabasco, you'll see the road and you will see that they have cattle grazing on one side, cattle grazing on the other. And that they need to be able to take the cattle from one to the other. Now, had they planned the road, having been there and seen where the cattle were, or the schools were and the towns were, they wouldn't have put roads, large roads, that cut through communities. And so the distrust is they're trying to divide us. They're trying to make us leave here. They're trying to kill my cattle because I can't cross the highway with the cattle. And the most, they'll give them a small little overpass. And it's like, try carrying a cow over that overpass. They're not going to go. So designing it from the offset where you could have it, you know, have a gradient, have a tunnel, and make sure that the communities would benefit. Most of the time, they didn't even know those communities were there because they're not official communities. So they've just sort of landed there. And since they weren't on the map and the person who designed it never left his or her office, they didn't take them into account. And so those were more from oversight than actual aggression towards communities. But there's both.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight that, you know, sometimes a certain action might not be ill-intended, but the outcome might deliver a negative externality sometimes or a negative outcome for the locals, and it might be perceived very differently because it looks different if you're a local and if a powerful government comes and simply does something that changes the environment that you live in. So I guess one takeaway here would be that policymakers would be well advised to plan well in advance and to go and check on site where these projects are being built and how they would impact the local communities as well. But I guess besides this takeaway, before we shift topics, if you had one key message to deliver to policymakers in Mesoamerica, what would it be and why?
Go to the communities and listen to people, because we have designed these projects in such a way that makes sense to us and our priorities, and not necessarily to them and their priorities. I had a really interesting interview with an NGO in Costa Rica. And I remember talking to him, and he said that to gain the community's trust, they went in and said, what do you want? And they were expecting them to say, we want a new school, we want a new hospital, we want nurses, we want housing. And they said, we want a football pitch. And they went, okay, football pitch. But they gave them the football pitch. And Then they realized why the community wanted was so desperate for a football pitch, because they wanted the young boys that were having a lot of issues with, you know, being just what we would say traviesos in Spanish. And they wanted them to have something to do and exercise and get out all their energy so then they could go to school and do all these other things. And so it might not have been the priorities that the government wanted, or that in this case, the NGO thought would be the most impactful. But it was what they wanted, is what the mothers wanted, is what they were asking for. And we tend to be so paternalistic and going there and saying, this is what you need. I'm sorry, they know what they need. And so if we don't go in and ask them, then we're going to give them what we think they need and not necessarily is what really it will be useful for them at that moment. So if we're doing a project that's for development, for helping a community come out, we need to ask them what they need.
Well, I hope that the policymakers in the Mesoamerican region do take your advice into account. Now, since we're in Mexico, let's shift topics a little bit and talk about this country and its role in the Mesoamerican region. How does Mexico see itself within the region? Does it view itself as a leader? Does it want to be a leader? How important is the region to Mexico compared to other international relationships or to the Americas more broadly, or other important key relationships with perhaps other regions or global players?
So I think Mexico's always considered Central America as their sphere of influence and having a lot to do there. And you hear it in the discourse of our current president and our previous presidents, ever since the beginning of the Plan Puebla Panamá. And there is a sense of inequality. In fact, from the Plan Puebla Panamá, they were very eager to join, but at the same time, not happy that 9 Mexican states were put at the same level as the Central American countries, right? So they were like, wait, no, that's a state and we're a country. I mean, as far as territory, they're about the same size, but you cannot consider the governor of a state at the same level as the president of a country. So that caused some friction there. There was an expectation that Mexico would invest a lot more and not just tell them how much to invest in their projects. And that was an issue. And they did get some outside funding from the Inter-American Development Bank. So that was helpful. And that was very welcome by all of them. And Mexico did do a lot of the administrative and a lot of the project vision and the project, setting out the project. Now, it was joined together, the Marcha hacia el Sur project was joined together with the Siglo XXI project from Central America. So there was a lot of Central American input, but at the end of the day, there is a sense when you talk to people in Central America that Mexico imposed a lot more than they were hoping for, and that Mexico invested a lot less than what they were hoping for. So that's sort of the role here.
Now, we've talked about Mexico's role in Mesoamerica, which I guess you can consider a sub-region if you view Latin America or the Americas as, or North America as a region in itself. Let's talk about Mexico's place in the broader regional context of the Americas. From an identity, from an economic, from a political standpoint, what's your view? Where does Mexico belong in the context of the Americas more broadly?
I think Mexico identifies a lot with Latin America and wants to, would like to be sort of the influential leader in Latin America, but that role's been taken a lot. So there is a sense of not quite sure where you want to belong. So Mexico's part of of Proyecto Mesoamerica, it is part of Grupo de los Tres, it is part of a lot of regional projects in Latin America as well. But of course, the elephant in the room, it is part of the North America project. So what used to be NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has now been rebranded as the USMCA and might be rebranded again at some point. It's supposed to have some reviewed by the treaty, it's supposed to be reviewed next year, but I think the current American president is trying to push it up to this year to try and get the review first. But so the rest of Latin America is like, yes, Mexico is part of Latin America, but not because of the close relationship with the United States and Canada.
Sure. So you mentioned that, of course, the U.S. is one of the dominant players in the region. And you mentioned that Mexico at the same time identifies with Latin America in many aspects. But there's also another, smaller elephant in the room, which is Brazil, a state that's been on the rise, both geopolitically and economically in some aspects. And that has also played, kind of a leadership role in a lot of regional organizations, such as UNASUR. How is the rise of Brazil viewed in Mexico?
I think that's been one of the points, that Mexico would like to take the leadership role, but Brazil has clearly gone ahead. And so that has been a point of, okay, we won't do so much with Latin America, we'll turn towards the north. But I'm not sure the view, I think it depends who's in power. How Mexico would view the rise of Brazil. I think they want to, there's a lot of friendliness with Brazil, but it also depends on who's in power and how well the leaders match up. So so for example, Lula and López Obrador, which was our previous president, they got along very well and they had a lot of the same views. Probably continues with Sheinbaum. But a change in Brazil's leadership might change that.
What was it like during Bolsonaro's term in Brazil?
We didn't hear much about Brazil, although there was a lot of clashing with López Obrador and his ideas with Bolsonaro. There wasn't that kind of compatibility as far as vision, as it were.
Yeah, so there is the same sort of theme that we see across South America, where when the governments are ideologically aligned in some way, it facilitates greatly cooperation or dialogue or, any form of connection between countries. Now, we spoke about Mexico's role in Latin America and the Americas. Let's turn to North America for a bit as well. You've mentioned to me that one of the books that you use to teach your students is on North American regionalism. Can you explain the key dimensions of North American regionalism and Mexico's role in it, especially because when we think about regionalism, we normally look at regions with a lot more states, and North America is quite a particular region in terms of its dynamics. So I think it would be really insightful for our audience if you could articulate what is North American regionalism.
Okay, well, I think when we talk about regionalism in itself, every single region is going to have a different definition. I really think that sometimes we're looking at it in the wrong way and trying to put regions in the same kind of boat. And when we look at, for example, Mexico and its role and how it belongs to so many regions, it gives us an idea of how different each of these regions actually is. No? How is it that Mexico can be part of so many different ones? No? Or even Central America, it's part of Proyecto Mesoamerica and it has its own integration, but it also is part of CAFTA with the US. So when we talk about these regional projects, they don't necessarily have that much of a common view, and it is so much so that they're overlapping because one is going to give you something different. So you can belong to one group that gives you one thing and then belong to another regional project that gives you something different. So that gives a bit of a different. And North America itself has very specific characteristics. One, the borders are huge between Mexico and the U.S. and the U.S. and Canada. They are... The U.S. and Canada have the longest border there. So, and they have very specific characteristics. Some natural barriers, like between Mexico and the U.S., the Rio Bravo or the Rio Grande, depending where you are. And now you're going to say the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf of America. So you know, we have different names, but these characteristics, you know, where the U.S. and Canada share language at some point with English, and Mexico and the U.S. don't. But if you look, then the U.S. has the largest Spanish-speaking population outside of a Latin American country. No? So you have a lot of cooperation that has naturally happened on issues that you have no control over. You just had to. So the U.S. and Canada have had to work with questions of, it was acid rain. So they had to sign an agreement back in the 80s, I think, because things like that don't know borders. So the rain or the pollution that comes up from one country rains on the other country. And so you have to come with an agreement, you have to work together to try and solve some of these issues that aren't going to stay within their little borders. And you have animals, you have water, you have, the US and Canada have to cooperate on the Great Lakes, for example, because they don't stay within their borders. The water flows both ways. And same thing with Mexico and the US. We share, they're two very arid areas, the south of the US and the north of Mexico. And when you share waterways, you have to cooperate. So some of these things, that's one of the specifics of North America. There are a lot of things that you have to cooperate on, whether you want to or not, or everybody loses.
Of course, there's a lot of, I guess, natural geographical factors that really determine who do you have to deal with when it comes to cooperation regionally. And of course, Mexico has to, deal these days with the U.S. and the new Trump administration. So I think everybody in our audience already has heard the news that Donald Trump has introduced tariffs on Mexican goods. He has adopted a much more assertive aggressive foreign policy stance. How has Mexico responded? How is this viewed in the country? And how do the public and the government think about Trump's administration and his, new foreign policy approach?
Well, I think it was expected. I mean, from the moment that Trump was running again for president, people were anticipating a very aggressive rhetoric, just from the campaigns themselves. When you're talking about stopping migration, stopping drug trafficking, stopping, making sure that we get, that the U.S. gets a better deal for in anything commercial, et cetera, you already had a sort of a preview of what was coming. So I don't think anyone was really surprised. I think they were surprised at how quickly it went. And in a way, people were very happy with the way the president of Mexico responded. Claudia Sheinbaum said, you give us tariffs, we'll give you tariffs. You put one thing up, we'll do exactly the same. And it is this first strong position, and kind of also making fun of him a little bit in some ways, that was received really well in Mexico. Then the negotiations and backing down took people by surprise at some point, but I think she's managed to spin it in a way of, I managed to save us from despair. And so we'll see how that keeps going. Now, the fact that Trump first said, okay, we'll put a pause on the tariffs because they're doing good stuff, and now he just the last couple of days has said we're not doing enough. The tariffs are going to go up anyway. It comes to be seen how much Mexico is willing to continue to give and to look weak before this president. We have to remember that the current president in Mexico has very high popular support, and so and is very keen on keeping popular support. So basically we'll see a lot of whatever the people want is what she's going to say, maybe not do, but just what she's going to say.
That's an interesting observation, that there is sort of I guess you could call it populist rhetoric and then pragmatic response or action on her part.
And we'll see how this plays out in practice and how long, I guess, she can keep this double act up in reality. Well, so you have this huge change in the U.S. foreign policy, which is, I guess, essential to Mexico and its engagement in the region as well. But looking beyond the Americas, we've seen other shifts in global order, or at least in the balance of power or economic resources and their distribution globally. Some would argue we're shifting towards a bipolar global order. Some would argue it's tripolar, with Russia being a key player militarily. Some would call it, I guess, a mix of both, such as Kishore Mahbubani's phrase of a bipolar sort of order in a multipolar sea. But in any case, the changes that are happening are real, and you can see it in the data and the economic trends. How is Mexico responding to these changes, if it's responding at all, particularly the rise of China or other trends such as the rise of Brazil or Europe's, I guess, relatively diminishing sort of role in global affairs? So what's Mexico's response to all of this?
I think Mexico hasn't really quite decided its response on many levels. Like, Mexico would like to expand more. You know, we have to take what is happening now. Right now, 80% of our exports go to the United States. So completely alienating yourself from the United States is going to be very painful for a long time. So that's something to really keep in mind as far as the choices. The USMCA has very clear provisions that Mexico cannot, for example, have a free trade agreement with China. That would cause it to but that would allow the other members to take it out, or Canada even. So, you know, what I see happening a lot right now is this grouping together and trying to figure out where you stand. So some have also called it sort of a re-regionalization, where the regions are becoming more important than global, from going from global more to regions again. I think that in an instance, we're seeing that regions are sort of closing in on themselves a bit, but that doesn't mean that they're not looking to where they can go next. So it's sort of a natural reaction of, oh, I'm going to hang on to my neighbor right now. But it may not be a long-term one. It may just be the short-term as they're trying to figure out what's going on. So if the rise of China, the rise of the BRICS, the rise of others get to a point where they're a much more interesting place to turn to, I think that would happen as well. Mexico was, if I'm not wrong, it's been an observer on many of the BRICS conferences. And, you know, not necessarily saying I want to join, but not necessarily saying I don't. So that's sort of what my feel is. I'm not in policy making with the groups, but that's sort of what I see.
Well, that's still a fascinating insight into the way that, I guess, some experts in Mexico might think about contemporary issues, and perhaps some of them might be listening to this conversation or reading the transcript. So even though you might not be in policy making, they might be interested in what you have to say about it. So your job is, of course, academic. So you teach politics. And let's talk about that for a little bit. That's both, I guess, a job and a passion for you, since we've had conversations about this, and you're very passionate about education. Now, there are many theories in political science and IR political philosophy, foreign policy, but as I was reading through your book, I noticed that you adopted an eclectic approach to theory. Can you explain what you mean by this? And can you also talk to us a little bit about how you approach teaching theory to your students? What's the purpose of theory? What is, I guess, the best way to use it or think about it? Is it to employ it to analyze case studies, or to critique it, or to use it as a starting point? How do you think about theory?
Okay, so the first thing about eclectic approach to theory has been how I've been labeled many times, more than how I consider it myself. I think I have a perfectly normal approach to theory, but yeah, that's been said to me more than once. When I teach theory, I try not to put a lot of my point of view. I tend to give a lot of different points of view on theory. And I tend to sum up my teaching of theory with a lot of different activities. I think theory is very abstract, so trying to teach it in a very concrete way is difficult. So one of the things I tend to do with students, for example, is I send them around campus and I give them something very vague. Like I'll say, you go take a photograph of the dining area. You go take a photograph of the library. You go take a photograph of the sports area. And in groups, so about five or six students will be taking the same photo or the same area. And of course, they all come back with a very different photograph. And when they come back with a different photograph, we say, okay, so what message are you giving? You know, some will be like a very close up, like the library. You can have someone taking a picture of books. You can have someone taking a picture of the computers. You can have someone taking pictures of the staff that helps you at the library. You can have a picture of the building way on the outside. You can have a picture of, I had one that took a picture of someone sleeping in the library. And so each one had a very different message. And what we ended up saying, you know, what the conclusion that you end up with is they're all photos of the library. However, depends on where you're standing, what your picture is going to look like. And that's what my approach to theory is where are you standing? What are you looking at? And where you're looking at is what theory, where you need to stand to be able to grasp. And that theories aren't going to give you the whole picture. They can't. They're going to give you a part of the picture. And you have to be very conscious that that theory is going to give you just that part of the picture. It's not going to give you everything. If you really want to see everything, you'd have to take a million pictures and look at them all. So that's sort of my approach. And I hope that that gives them an idea of what theory is for. And, you know, when we get to, you know, different photos, once we get the photos, we say, okay, what's missing? You know, so for example, if you're trying to talk about cafeteria food offer, you might take a picture of all the different stands and all the places they can get food. But if you want to think about how much waste is happening in the cafeteria, you take a picture of the bin, you know, and seeing how much food waste is there. So it depends on what you want to look at and what story you want to tell, where you're going to stand and what photograph you're going to take.
It sounds a little bit like the old story with the blind man and the elephant.
There we go.
All of them are touching different parts of the elephant, of course. Now, this is, a very educational and instructive approach to a useful way that we can understand, interpret, and, use theory in a way that enables you to position it correctly within what's happening in the world. Now, you're also working on classroom games. You're preparing a presentation at the International Studies Conference on classroom games. Can you share a little bit about how you use them in your teaching and why do you use them? Is it for increasing engagement, illustrating concepts, or simulating practical situations for the students, or perhaps something else?
I think it's to sort of ground a lot of what is being taught and bring it back, like with the photographs. You know, it's going a bit abstract. It's doing activities that you hope will give them that are memorable and that they will at least remember the concept. So they may not remember all the authors of the theories, but they will remember going around campus and taking pictures. They may not remember, and then that might, you know, click and go, oh yeah, I remember what we were talking about there. So the different games that I might do in class, or the different role plays or activities that we'll do in class, I'm hoping will give them a little more to think about. So for example, one thing I've done, and I actually did this on an exam but now I've done it role play in class. But when we were doing the pandemic, I was trying to figure out what can I do that I'm going to know that they're actually learning something and that they're, you know, that they're just not going to copy off their notes. So what I had them do, I called it in Spanish, en el bar del más allá, you know, in like a heaven's bar or whatever, or your two dead economists walk into a bar was sort of the premise. And to take two economists and say, okay, so you're going to talk, you know, Adam Smith and Karl Marx are going to talk about what gives something value, no? And so they would have to try and like argue, and obviously they got entertaining, and you know, they slammed chairs over each other's heads and they drank tequila, and they, you know, and they got really, really creative. But the idea is that they could probably come out, and they, you know, obviously they would use their notes, but they would take what they took the note from Adam Smith and have to, how would they explain it to Karl Marx? You know, how would he explain it in his words? How would, how would Marx explain to David Ricardo something else? So, you can use it with so many other figures. How would Abraham Lincoln explain something to Donald Trump? No, exactly. So to get really the essence of what they do, and it's a bit of creative thought, but it's just also so that you know they're not just learning facts that they're going to forget.
Yeah, it's a little bit about putting yourself, I guess, in someone's shoes, seeing it from their perspective, which I guess draws some parallels to the ways that you think about theory. So mm-hmm. that might be, in a way, the underpinning for your approach to classroom games, I'm guessing. Now, as we move towards the end of the podcast, I ask all of the guests on the show to give some recommendations to our audience. There is a vast literature on Latin American politics and Latin American regionalism as well, but it's not too easy to navigate. One main reason is because some works are in English, some in Spanish, some in Portuguese, and also there's a lot of different academic communities that are scattered across different countries. So if you could recommend a few essential resources on Latin American regionalism and politics to our audience, these could be books, papers, databases, media channels, documentaries, movies, anything you like, what would your top recommendations be?
Just in general of Latin American regionalism, I know Nicola Phillips has quite a few compilations on Latin America and IPE in general. We've done quite a few studies there. Obviously, when Robert Pastor is like essential reading for North American regionalism. I think understanding Latin America is not just the integration part, but a lot of the history, because integration and disintegration have come together with history. So if you read a lot, the military government in Peru, you really don't understand how it fit in with the Pactandino and the times it left and came in, and like all of those politics go together. So Latin American integration is just about as much about history and a lot of the big moments in Latin America as it is about integration itself. You don't understand Mercosur unless you understand what happened in Chile and why Mercosur opens up and then closes up, and that. All of that, it comes in so tied together that it's really important to do both. But I think I would start there, looking at Latin American history, and then also some of the books of scholars that have written about Latin American integration as well.
Yeah, it's very insightful to hear not just, the names of authors, but also the reasons why you would recommend them or why you think they would be an essential reading or the best starting point in terms of thinking about Latin American regionalism as well. Now, you've shared with us very gracefully a lot of insights, and this conversation has been, an eye-opener for me in terms of Mesoamerica in particular, and you've shared a lot of interesting analysis of other issues as well, such as Mexican politics. Now, before I let you go, my last question is, what are your future research plans? So for anybody in our audience who's interested in your work and would like to follow you, what should they expect to see from you? What kind of projects, publications, what kind of topics are you currently working on?
Okay, so right now, back on the North America and how different the region is, we're looking. I'm working with Dr. Arturo Flores on a book project, and what we're looking for is authors who that are from the different countries. So each chapter is going to be authored by someone based in Mexico, someone based in the U.S. Someone based in Canada, or at least two of the three countries, so that you get a little bit wider lens on what's going on from both points of view. I mean, if you read things on migration, in Mexico, they're going to be completely different as what you read about migration in the U.S., that what you read about migration in Canada. So the idea is a bit to get this flow and to get the conversation amongst the authors themselves. So that's one. But our main focus is going to be governance, and not just governmental, but governance. How cooperation takes place? How do these networks happen? How do they come up? And you know, in the case of the USMCA being, you know, shut away, as we say, the cooperation and a lot of the regional integration, if you would call it, the deeper integration, was happening before NAFTA, before the USMCA, and if the USMCA goes away, it'll happen. It will still go on. So that's what we want to look at. So I know a couple of the chapters. There's one on the cooperation for the whales. So that's a very, ongoing project that's been working on the whales that go on the coast from Canada down to Baja California. And there's a really interesting cooperation there. Another one, I don't think we're going to have that in chapter, but very similar happens with the butterflies. You know? So the butterflies migrate among the three countries. And then looking at cooperation in water, cooperation in technology. There's a lot going on with technology, and that they just have to cooperate. There's just no other way about it.
Sounds like a fascinating project, and it's also in line with, I guess, the globalization of international relations and international politics research as well. So I'm looking forward to your book, and I hope that our audience is. So thank you very much for joining the show, New Regional Orders, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.